KZSU FM Stanford. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. Today I'm excited to have on the show Professor Mike Madison of the University of Pittsburgh Law School, co-author of an article with Brett Frischman, a previous guest on the show, and Catherine Strandberg, entitled Constructing Commons in a Cultural Environment. The commons is something that that copyright scholars in particular and really the public at large is and should be interested in. It revolves around the idea and ways in which we can have culture, we can have books and works of art and so forth available to the public for use without requiring permission of the author, without requiring that the user or consumer of that content pay for a license, get permission from the author, or in any way be encumbered ultimately from using it based upon ideas of ownership. And in constructing commons in the cultural environment, Mike and Brett and Catherine, and Brett and Catherine are not joining us today, so I'll be chatting with Mike Madison, the lead author of the article, discuss the elements necessary to create such a commons. What do commons look like? What kind of characteristics should they have or do they have? How can we encourage the creation of commons more broadly? And this is a topic that has been of particular interest in the last, 10, 15 years at least, given the rise of intellectual property law as a growing force in regulating the relationships between private entities, regulating the relationships between the consuming public and content creators and other relationships. And so in constructing commons in the cultural environment, Mike, and I'll refer to the article as his for the remainder of the show for ease of discussion. Mike takes a look at how, in fact, these commons will develop and should they develop in certain formats and with certain elements that we're going to get into in more detail. And this is a topic that we discussed frequently on Hearsay Culture, both from the perspective not only of IP scholars and lawyers, but also from the perspective of economists, business people, and even technologists. So this cuts a wide swath through the topics that we cover on Hearsay Culture. And I'm excited to have Mike on, someone that I've wanted to have on the show for several years and have finally been able to work it in. So I'm excited to have Mike here. By way of background, Mike writes and teaches about information law and theory. He teaches a variety of IP law courses as well as contracts and commercial law. He joined the Pitt faculty in 1998. He practiced in California before then, and he is the faculty director of the Innovation Practice Institute and professor of law at Pitt Law School. Thank you much for joining us on Hearsay Culture, Mike. I appreciate you taking the time.
Good morning.
Let's start off our discussion, Mike, with a question that I often ask most virtually all of my authors, which is the genesis of this project. What was the impetus for writing this article, and how did you become interested in this topic?
Well, the article evolved over a long series of conversations, initially between myself and Brett Frischman. We've been friends and colleagues for a long time, writing in related areas. Brett had written a piece reviewing Yochai Benkler's book, The Wealth of Networks, and Brett's review focused on the idea of cultural environmentalism and collective production, or what Benkler calls peer production of cultural works. And I'd written a long piece that was published about 5 years ago now, talking about the nature of legal things, sort of intangible things that the legal system deals with in the patent system and the copyright system and the trademark system and the ways in which that all works. And Brett and I got to talking about our sort of overlapping sort of thematic interests and realized that there was a way to marry my interest in the way the legal system builds objects and how those objects then get manipulated and worked with in cultural context that Brett was referring to as environments. So we just sort of married our intellectual interests and realized that there was a big landscape to explore that we linked up with Eleanor Ostrom and her work on commons, more in the natural resources environment. So we're bringing a lot of different threads to bear simultaneously. Initially, Brett and I were working, talking about this project with Joe Miller, who's an IP professor at Lewis and Clark. Joe was a tremendous early contributor to the project in terms of shaping it, but ultimately decided to go and do some other research. And we approached Kathy Strandberg, who is also a great friend of ours in IP, now at NYU, to see if she was interested in participating in this. Kathy brings the perspective not only as a great IP scholar, but also as somebody who is a PhD in physics, and so has the training in sort of research from a more rigorous standpoint than is sometimes associated with legal scholarship. We thought that that was an important perspective to bring to the team. So that's how this sort of came about, was sort of overlapping thematic interests from different perspectives. Brett has more of an economist frame to bring to this, plus the environmentalism theme. I have historically been more interested in legal theory, metaphor, and those kinds of questions. And so we're trying to bring a lot of different pieces to the same problem.
Can you talk a little bit about, and I ask these questions, this is more structural, but I cover these from time to time, about the collaborative process and putting an article like this together, especially where, as you mentioned, while you're all law professors, you otherwise have very divergent backgrounds and perhaps interests to some degree. Some of the challenges of doing that, even among friends.
Well, we've been fortunate in that we are all very good friends. And so just at a personal level, we get along spectacularly well. And one of the great benefits of this project has been getting to know two great people even better than we knew one another previously. So it's been very rewarding at that level. The challenges primarily have been sort of time management, in the sense that we're all very, very busy people. We all have lots of projects going on in our lives, in addition to this commons enterprise. And so there's been a bit of a challenge just scheduling, getting things done. We've made a commitment early on to have periodic meetings in person. I'm in Pittsburgh. At the time we started the project, both Brett and Kathy were located in Chicago. They have since relocated to different schools in the New York area. So it's not the most complicated challenge in the world to get together in person, but it's not seamless either. So we've had to do a little bit of negotiating on that score. We have slightly different work styles. We have slightly different writing styles. We have slightly different intellectual styles. We have found that all of those things tend to complement each other. We really haven't had any obstacles or roadblocks that we've had to figure out how to overcome along the way. I've collaborated with other people in other contexts, and it's, as you say, it's interesting to compare and contrast one collaboration with others, because you know everyone is kind of unique.
That's right, and unfortunately, they do run the range of experiences from very positive ones, as you described, to others that aren't quite as positive, which would be a topic for another day. The commons itself, I mean, you know, like as I mentioned in the introduction, this is a topic that, you know, we've covered from time to time on Hearsay Culture. In fact, when Brett was on early on in the genesis of Hearsay Culture, he discussed his work on infrastructure, which I know you know quite well. And the discussion there revolved partially around the commons. What is your particular interest in the commons itself? And I guess I'll start with that broad question, which is, how do you define, in general terms, a commons before we get into more detail?
So we tend to try to avoid characterizing things as a commons or the commons. So our vocabulary and terminology in this project is related to, but a little bit distinct from, the way commons is generally tossed around in sort of cultural contexts or cultural conversations. And that's largely because we are looking at it from the standpoint of sort of Ostrom's political theory perspective. So we talk about commons as a governance structure rather than as a particular place or as a particular thing. So instead of the commons, we talk about commons, and we use commons as a governance structure to refer to almost any structured collection of shared resources, right? So the idea is that a commons is a way to talk about a structured sharing environment where people have contributed resources, manage those resources amongst themselves, and have a set of rules or standards for using those resources in next generation iterations. And we got interested in talking about this in the cultural context, partly because Ostrom herself has been so successful and has gotten to be so well known for talking about commons in the natural resources context, forests, fisheries, water systems, grazing systems, and so forth. We thought, well, is there a way to talk about those same commons ideas in the cultural context, you know, in human creativity, innovation, culture generally? And we thought it was interesting because Brett and Kathy and I all thought very clearly that this kind of conversation is missing from standard ways to talk about and think about intellectual property problems, right? The standard ways being you have to have proprietary rights, or you have government subsidies to provide for these kinds of innovations or creativity, or you have the public domain, right? Completely open, unstructured, anything goes kinds of environments. And we thought, you know, there's a big, big missing middle in that conversation. And that's really what we're trying to do with the paper and project about commons, is open up a big space for conversation about these phenomena that we see in our daily lives, but we don't have a good way of talking about.
So it's commons as a verb or an adjective rather than a noun, in that sense, not to become William Sapphire, but it's a descriptive term for a way of doing business as opposed to a place, which reminds me, and I'm curious to get your perspective on this. Previously on the show, we've had guests on to talk about peer-to-peer. The same way, peer-to-peer not as a place, but peer-to-peer as a method, and to encourage the use of peer-to-peer ideas beyond technology. Is that part of what you envision with this project and with this paper?
I guess in part, yes. In two senses. In part, in the sense that you started off with, which is that there's an interesting application of language and metaphor that we want to surface in this conversation. So a lot of times legal analysis scholars want to take the specifics of language and metaphor that they take it for granted, rather than bringing it to the surface and trying to study the actual implications of why we talk about things the way we talk about things. That's not the be-all and end-all, but it's something that is relevant and significant. So the fact that we want to use commons in a certain way from a linguistic standpoint is interesting to us. Then on the second point, that this is really a sort of a descriptive tool that has to do with a certain style of reasoning or a certain style of organizing, I think really captures something very important about what we're up to. This is primarily a descriptive project at this point from our standpoint. We certainly have our instincts and intuitions about the values and benefits of a commons approach, but we don't want to put too much emphasis early on the idea that we're cheerleaders for commons in all settings.
We're chatting with Professor Mike Madison of Pitt Law, who is joining us via Skype from his home in Pittsburgh. With regard to the commons, or a commons, excuse me, I'm going to be careful in how I use it in our conversation. The title of the article is Constructing Commons in the Cultural Environment. And I know that this is a question that you got from commentators, because your article was the subject of several responses from many notable scholars, including Eleanor Ostrom herself. With regard to the word constructing, I know you got this comment, and I want to ask it up front. What do you mean by constructing commons? What work does the word constructing do for the project that you're speaking about?
Well, it does a couple of things, so it's a little bit of a pun. The first thing that it does is the word constructing refers to the idea that commons are designed and built by human activity. Commons don't just happen. Commons don't just exist naturally in the world. Commons are the product of a variety of things, and the paper talks in a lot of detail about the elements of a particular institutional design. Commons come about because of law. Commons come about because of economics and business considerations. Commons come about because of assumptions about the nature of the resources that are involved, and so forth. And a lot of the paper is directed to describing those different features and how the different mechanisms of institutional design can be understood. The second way in which constructing is doing some work in the title of the project has to do with the sense of constructing as understanding, that any given commons has some shared features with other commons, but any given commons also has some distinctive features. And so it's really important to look at a given common setting and saying, what exactly are the relevant features that drive commons here? And that's simply a task of understanding rather than a task of advocacy.
And it's, you know, as we have a discussion about this article, I'm always careful to decipher and define academic jargon so that when I say what work does it do, I think in the outside world, that means what does that mean? And so for those that are wondering what that phraseology is, there it is. So with regard to this title, and these are really the basic questions, Mike, before we get into the details of the project, a cultural environment is what?
So the idea of the cultural environment captures the idea that there are overlapping systems at work in a given setting. So we don't mean cultural environment to be too technical or too jargony. It really captures the idea that whether you're looking in a patent setting or a copyright setting or any other cultural context, whether you have a legal overlay or not, you've got a number of different systems at work at the same time. They work at different levels, from the more specific to the more general. They work side by side with one another. So you've got law, you've got business, you've got history, you've got individual personality and so forth. And what we're trying to capture with this word, the environment, is how these things have to be understood as operating together.
So we're chatting with Mike Madison on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. And I should have mentioned, I really should have mentioned this up front, the most important part of your biography from Stanford's standpoint is that you are a graduate of the law school. So that's something I should have said immediately in the introduction. With regard to this idea, and this is really the last background question, Mike, before we get into detail. So you've mentioned Eleanor Ostrom several times, and her work does form a significant part of the foundation of the article. For those that aren't familiar, who is Ostrom, and why did you build your theories or partially build the theories around her?
So Eleanor Ostrom is a senior political scientist at Indiana University in Bloomington, who wrote a seminal book back in the mid-1980s called Governing the Commons. And since that time, through the present time, she has been a leading figure in the study of commons systems in the natural resource environment primarily worldwide. In fact, Eleanor Ostrom was one of the two winners of the Nobel Prize in Economics last year for her work on commons. So she's part of a broader movement within economic theory that's called New Institutional Economics that really takes the idea of institutional structures and institutional design as the primary subject of economic analysis. And so she's one of the major inspirations for our project, is trying to adapt some of her perspective, some of her theories, some of her arguments into the cultural context.
The idea of cultural environmentalism is one that goes back a little ways to work by Jamie Boyle and others. Again, for definitional purposes, it means what?
Well, as originally designed by Jamie Boyle and other folks working in his tradition, the idea of the environmental metaphor for culture was to capture the idea that there's a great deal about culture that's worth preserving and stewarding and managing that conversations about intellectual property law and policy had gotten too invested in the idea that novelty and innovation and forward-moving progress was the be-all and end-all of IP theory. So Jamie and others were really trying to bring some balance to that debate. What we've done by borrowing the environmental metaphor for our work is to really build on that. We're not trying to displace it in any way, but really saying that you need to understand the environmental metaphor in its institutional setting rather than simply as a political mantra.
The turning from the foundational questions to where we are right now and then working towards what you propose in the article, you talk in the article a bit about whether we have anything that looks like a cultural commons, and you mentioned Wikipedia and others. Perhaps you could talk about a couple of those examples. In other words, where are we now versus where we might go based upon your project?
Well, if you actually stand back and think about cultural commons, one interesting feature of the cultural landscape today is that commons are all around us. But they aren't often recognized as common. So one of the things we're trying to do is put out a framework for people to capture a lot of this collective, this common understanding and put it in sort of a comparative institutional context. So Wikipedia would be a pretty good example of a modern context where commons principles are at work. You've got an institutional structure, Wikimedia, Wikipedians, the set of governance rules that govern contribution, use, and management of conflicts in the Wikipedia environment. But the core of Wikipedia is shared resources, shared information, people putting content into Wikipedia, blending it with other content contributed by other people, and then making that available for downstream use. In the Wikipedia context, that's all free in the sense that no one is being charged money to participate, no one's being charged money to use, but it's also governed in the sense that there's a set of rules and restrictions that are not hard-edged. No one's coming in with a sledgehammer, no one's suing anybody else over what to do about Wikipedia, but there are conflicts in Wikipedia, the context there, and there's a set of rules for managing that, and there's a set of people who are in charge of applying the rules and making sure that all more or less runs appropriately. You can look historically, as we do in the paper, and look at earlier instances of what we would call commons governance. One of the things in the paper that I find most interesting personally is wire services for professional journalism. So we talk in the paper a bit about the Associated Press. People think of the Associated Press to the extent that they think of the Associated Press as basically a wire service. You're a newspaper, a magazine, a radio station, a TV station, what have you. You are a member of the Associated Press, and as a member, you have the ability to contribute content to the AP, put it out over the wire. You have the ability to pull stuff off of the wire and print it in your publication or your media outlet. So there's a membership structure built in there. There are rules for contributing stuff to the pool. There are rules for pulling stuff out of the pool. That actually is not a cost-free or zero-payment kind of environment. Their money does change hands within the Associated Press venue. But what you see in the AP, and by analogy to Wikipedia, is you see a mechanism for individual people contributing what we would call cultural content, news stories, into a shared environment, the AP wire, with mechanisms for other people to pull stuff out of that pool and use it for their own purposes, using that content to build downstream daily papers or magazines or what have you. The AP has been around for decades and a very, very successful mechanism. I mean, a lot of people would say that a large number of news magazines and newspapers wouldn't be able to exist, particularly the smaller market papers, without access to the AP. So the Associated Press, in a historical sense, really illustrates some of the really tangible benefits of looking at a cultural environment in a commons way rather than simply in a proprietary rights way. Wikipedia, obviously, is a 21st century, modern internet-driven version of a commons, but I think it's important to see the continuity between this commons context or commons concept in modern application and the same principles operating in a more historical sense. One last thing on this point. The Associated Press is not a controversy-free kind of a scenario, just as Wikipedia is not a controversy-free kind of scenario. So we do not hold up any of these examples as models of, gee, aren't commons always wonderful things? Commons have some specific risks and drawbacks, and maybe we'll talk about that shortly.
Well, that's that last point is something I wanted to get to, and get to it now up front, because you're not making a normative judgment about commons or commons being good or bad per se. And I think the current example, perhaps, I'll ask if it is one, of the commons is WikiLeaks, in a sense. And so I'm curious to get your reaction to WikiLeaks, as an entity using commons theory.
Well, I think WikiLeaks, obviously controversial, let me make a couple of quick observations. Yep. One is that normative judgments about commons environments might be based on criteria that are pulled in from external sources, right? So people might criticize WikiLeaks for reasons having to do with interests in transparency in government and foreign policy, privacy and confidentiality interests, all of which have nothing specifically to do with commons, because these are normative judgments that could be made with respect to any kind of sort of investigation, distribution, publication mechanisms. And then there's a second set of normative judgments that are, to a certain degree, internal to the idea of commons themselves. That is, we're more interested in the external stuff, because those are things that are specifically related to the internal dynamics of the idea of commons. My personal reaction to WikiLeaks is that the controversy over WikiLeaks doesn't so much have to do with the commons principle that is part of what they're doing. The controversy over WikiLeaks more depends on these external judgments about the wisdom of transparency in the conduct of foreign relations and government. The internal stuff, I think, is the more interesting stuff from our standpoint, because it's more generalizable potentially across a wide variety of common settings.
Is it not true that any entity that uses commons theory will be subject to the same push and pull? In other words, that WikiLeaks itself, because of its behavior, as you point out, has put itself in the crosshairs of a number of very powerful entities, starting with governments, that are not happy to see their secrets revealed without limitation to the public. So it's an extreme example. But even, as you mentioned, an entity like Wikimedia, which runs Wikipedia, and the others that you mentioned in the article, are also subject to those external forces that, for example, with Wikipedia, that people criticize it for not being trustworthy, not by virtue of any nefarious purpose like WikiLeaks might be criticized of, but more because we don't know who's creating the content. So I guess my question is WikiLeaks an extreme example of the commons perhaps gone amok, or is it really something that we need to put in a separate category?
I guess my initial reaction is that it's more of a separate category than an extreme example. And the reason is this. Suppose that Julian Assange took it upon himself to be a solo crusader with respect to government transparency and found a source in some State Department bureau or an officer in the military somewhere who was willing to share a lot of detailed information with him as an individual, and then Julian Assange then decided to share that information onward, posting it online or handing it over to the New York Times or what have you. I think if he were acting as a solo intermediary in that way, he would be subject to the same kind of criticism that you've actually heard expressed relative to WikiLeaks. Or to turn that same point around, suppose that WikiLeaks were able to say, we have a really strong internal set of controls, analogous to Wikipedia, that sort of governs where we get our information, how we vet the information. We've ensured that the information is authentic and of a significant public interest, and so we're only putting the good stuff out there. And if WikiLeaks went public with that kind of a framework, I think that WikiLeaks would still get all kinds of criticism rained down on it for being behaving in an inappropriate way. And you know, the merits of that criticism, I think, are a debate for a different day. But that's why I think Wikipedia is sort of a different category, because the criticism of Wikipedia is that anyone can contribute, right? Anyone, in theory, anyone can log in, create an account, and start adding content to Wikipedia pages, and there are no rules. And once you study the internal mechanics of Wikipedia, you recognize that that criticism is overblown. And so that's the point of our commons analysis, is that you really have to study sort of the internal dynamics of a particular commons setting to understand what are the formal rules, what are the informal rules that govern the internal mechanics, and then what are the rule sets that govern the intersection between what happens on the inside and how outsiders interact with it. The WikiLeaks situation, so far as I know, is not characterized by a dialogue about all of those questions.
We're chatting with Professor Mike Madison of Pitt Law on KCSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture, and we're going to pick up those internal dynamics and characteristics after the public service announcement, which has become part of the structure of Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that Hearsay Culture is on KCSU-FM Stanford, a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming, maybe a commons in and of itself. For those of you that are interested in making a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of options. You can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU, or you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Regardless, I do hope you continue to listen to KZSU and to Hearsay Culture. So, Mike, several times you've referred to the internal characteristics of commons, and this is a very broad question, but we can start at the top level and work in more detail. What are, broadly, the characteristics of a commons as your project defines it?
So the most basic characteristic is that a commons is defined by resources being shared. And when I say resources, that those resources could take one of two forms as an initial baseline. One initial form might be patents or copyrights or other specific legal forms of IP. So that once something has been bundled as a patent, then different patent holders might take different patent rights, put them into some kind of patent pool or some kind of collection where other people or other participants in some industry can then use that patented technology. So the classic instance here that we talk about in the paper is an older patent pool called the Manufacturers Aircraft Association back in World War I, when airplanes were basically brand new technologies, but there were lots and lots of patents floating around on different pieces of airplane technology. In order for the U.S. military to be able to build airplanes, all of those patents had to somehow be aggregated so a specific manufacturer could have access to all those different technologies without being required to pay an exorbitant number of patent royalties. So a patent pool was formed so that anybody who wanted to build airplanes could basically go to the pool, sort of a one-stop shopping scenario where they could use all of that patent technology. Everybody who owned patents could get appropriate payment. But the airplanes could get built and they could fight in the war. The second baseline in terms of shared resources are pieces of culture or pieces of content that are not originally characterized as coming from the IP rights system. So this is where Wikipedia would be a good example of this, where individual contributions to a particular Wikipedia article may be characterized as copyrightable contributions if they meet the standards of copyright law, but that's not how people engage with Wikipedia. When you're editing an article, when you're uploading content to a Wikipedia article, you're just writing your particular contribution, you're just adding your particular edits. And so no one at the front end is thinking consciously about a copyright negotiation. they're just accumulating knowledge in a shared pool. Once you've contributed those resources to the pool, then there's the back end, which is how those resources are combined and what kind of rules or social norms govern how that combined collection of resources can be used downstream. So it really is a mechanism for aggregating contributions and then setting up a mechanism for people to use those aggregated contributions.
The idea of the commons, and when you talk about these characteristics, it's something to discuss. The idea of the commons has sometimes been denigrated as being a euphemism for no one should have any rights over their work, and I think it's misused in that way. But you find critics of the commons as taking it to mean that if you support a commons or the commons, and I am purposely using the phrase differently because it is used differently in the world generally, you somehow are opposed to intellectual property rights, particularly copyright, but perhaps others. And I want to get your reaction to that. I mean, have you found that to be the case in your own experience? And what do you think can be done about it?
Well, we've definitely had some head-scratching reactions from people who've heard us present our work, I think precisely for the reason that you described, that rhetorically, commons has come to be used as an oppositional term, right? Either you've got IP or you've got commons. There's no meaningful way to combine the two. And we are very definitely saying that IP rights can be part of commons environments. A patent pool is something that we would characterize as a commons, but it's a commons that depends on and builds on IP rights rather than trying to get away from IP rights. There are clearly other commons that have different kinds of relationships to IP rights. When I talked earlier about the Associated Press and wire services, that's a setting where there's a bit of copyright built into the structure of the Associated Press environment. There's also the classic old Supreme Court case of International News Service versus Associated Press, which described the idea of hot news appropriation in the tort law context. That also is a big part of the story of how the Associated Press got going and how it originally functioned. So there's definitely some symbiosis between IP rights and commons in our framing. How to overcome this rhetorical opposition going forward is a real challenge, but I think our strategy is to have put our paper out there and then really to push the idea that people need to do more specific case study research on particular commons, both in the contemporary setting and historically, to show just how diverse and really useful common settings are and have been over time. So make these less of an exception and more of a normal part of the cultural conversation.
We're chatting with Professor Mike Madison of University of Pittsburgh Law School at KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So with regard to commons, one of the challenges, and it's one that you discuss a bit in the paper, is that at the same time that people are consuming whatever is in the commons, it also needs to be produced. And this is a classic challenge, the tragedy of the commons, the tragedy of the anti-commons. There's been, you know, quite a bit of literature in this area. How, in your view, do you encourage both the consumption and production of resources in a cultural commons? How do your characteristics fit in with that?
Well, we're trying to be pretty broad in attacking that question by looking not only to the standard economic incentives models that intellectual property doctrine historically relies on to make sure that people have appropriate financial incentives to contribute to the production of anything, whether it's for their own benefit or as part of a common scenario, but also looking very specifically at social norms, other community customs, other informal systems, both contemporary and historical, that motivate people to produce stuff and share stuff. Right. So the standard economic account of intellectual property law assumes number one, that people are behaving in an individual sense, that the idea of people are the idea that people will behave deliberately as part of a collective is something that's a little bit foreign to standard IP theory. And the other assumption that traditional IP theory makes is that these individual creators will behave essentially selfishly, that I will create something so long as I can generate enough of an economic return by selling it to pay myself off in an appropriate way. And we're a little skeptical, actually we're quite a bit skeptical in our project that both of these conditions are so absolutely true. It's sort of intuitively obvious if you look around that people are creating and producing things in social settings all the time, that people self-identify as part of collections of people. You know, I'm an individual, I'm a law professor, I write law, I write academic articles and research, but I'm also part of a community of law professors, I'm part of a discipline of intellectual property law, and I'm very much aware when I write my articles and produce my research that I am part of that community in addition to contributing my individual effort. Second, I think people are far more willing to accept the idea of being generous and sharing their stuff for a variety of very, very good reasons than IP theory generally supposes. So there's an enormous variety of settings in which the idea of voluntarily sharing your stuff with a community is baked into the structure of that community. And, you know, the paradigm of that, again, is academia. But what you can step out of academia and find lots of settings where the idea of voluntarily sharing your stuff, whether you get a reward for it or not, is actually quite acceptable. Again, I think Wikipedia is a really interesting example of precisely that phenomenon. It's a lot of puzzlement about why people would contribute to Wikipedia, and I think that part of the answer is that people just like the idea of sharing. That's not the entirety of it, but I think that's an element of it. If you take a look at the Creative Commons project, which is, again, it's a Creative Commons is a tool, not an outcome. But I think part of the instinct underneath the Creative Commons as a legal structure that facilitates people getting their created content out in front of other audiences is the idea that people are willing to do that. Now, they're not willing always to do that, just, you know, fly and be free and let anybody else take what they want. They're going to put conditions on it, and there's a structure to those conditions, and I think the structure there is quite important. But the baseline instinct that people are interested and willing to create simply as part of a mechanism of sharing it, I think is an insight that we all need to take seriously and that we want to incorporate into our understanding of how commons work.
Chatting with Mike Madison of Pitt Law on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. I should also note this show is being recorded on February 15th, the same day that it will air. It'll air in a few hours after the recording. So we have about 10 minutes or so left, Mike, and this is where I get to the unfair portion of the show, and unfair in a sense that you don't have enough time sometimes to answer the question in a satisfying way. And so suddenly this somewhat leisurely conversation becomes potentially fast-paced. I try to avoid it. But given that Hearsay Culture focuses heavily on the intersection of intellectual property law concepts and technology, I'd like to spend the last several minutes that we have before asking you about your own views on what researchers should focus on with regard to commons and your own projects to talk a little bit about technology. And this is another we've mentioned it a fair amount with regard to wikis, but more broadly, and I know again this was a comment you received on the article. What is the role of technology in cultural commons? How would you define it?
Well, I think in the modern sense, probably the most important role of technology is platform development, right? So that whether we're talking about wikis or YouTube or file sharing technology or BitTorrent or what have you, you know, technology plays an essential role potentially in facilitating building collections of content and making collections of content available for downstream use. And so both the technological design and the legal rules that govern technological design are absolutely critical in figuring out whether a particular technology venue can serve as a platform for a commons, right? So you can compare the wiki technology, which has been very, very successful in supporting commons of a variety of sorts, right? So Wikipedia being one extremely well-known, extremely successful application of wiki technology to build what I think is a pretty robust commons, and then compare that to the YouTube technology, which is much more contentious as a technology platform for a variety of understandable reasons, having to do with its intersection with the entertainment business, having to do with YouTube's ownership by Google. But you can do some comparing and contrasting between how the different those different technologies have been rolled out, regulated, and treated rhetorically or analytically as platforms for commons venues. Or the Wikipedia setting, that's basically a technology-driven commons, and people talk about it conversationally as a commons environment without too much controversy. There's pros and cons to Wikipedia, there's sort of pros and cons to a particular commons construct, but there's not a lot of debate that Wikipedia at its core is basically driving a commons. YouTube, on the other hand, is not only controversial in terms of its application because of the perceived threat to entertainment interests and copyright-owning interests, and controversial in part because of its ownership by Google, but YouTube is also not accepted as, rhetorically accepted as a technology platform for a commons. So for me to talk about YouTube as a commons platform, I think is going to strike people as a little bit less intuitive than to talk about Wikipedia as a commons. So that, I think that illustrates, number one, sort of the diverse role that technology plays here. It also illustrates the challenges of blending commons analysis with sort of, a very dynamic technology space.
And that gets us, Mike, to the follow-up question, which is, as you scan the commons or commons environments, what do you see as the biggest thing that we as a society are getting wrong about commons, and what should researchers do about it?
Well, I think the biggest thing we get wrong is that we don't understand the significance of commons in culture generally, right? So that, again, to take YouTube as an example, I don't think that commons is an all-purpose solution to the various controversies that surround YouTube, but I do think that thinking about YouTube and analyzing YouTube as a commons structure would add depth and nuance to what currently is a fairly blunt-edged argument in the YouTube context about copyright. Right, so YouTube is being debated as, what are the rights of content owners versus what are the rights of YouTube users? And that's a very sort of binary, black and white kind of debate that to some extent is given to us by the structure of the Copyright Act, but it's also given to us sort of by the inherited rhetoric of how we talk about culture and content. So if we introduce the commons construct, introduce the commons analysis to that YouTube discussion and explore all of the different features of commons that we go through in our article, all the different levers, all the different elements that go into understanding how a commons works, introduce that analysis into the YouTube environment, you open up venues for research, venues for analysis, venues for dialogue about the strengths and weaknesses of YouTube that you really don't see represented very well in the contemporary debate. I don't imagine for a second that I'm able to persuade a Hollywood movie studio that talking about YouTube as a commons is going to satisfy all their concerns. Mm-hmm. But I do think that by raising the salience of a commons analysis in the YouTube context will help society as a whole, ideally, put the concerns of the Hollywood motion picture studios in context.
And, I'm sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
I'm done with that.
Yeah, no, I guess to sound an encouraging note along those lines, it wasn't too long ago, when the idea of open business models and open business environments was viewed as frankly as laughable. Why would a company looking to turn profits possibly share proprietary information when it could keep it secret and hold it and lock it down and in that way generate revenues? And we've seen a slow but sure development towards sharing of information by entities that traditionally hadn't, precisely because it serves those goals of profit making and of ultimately making better products. And so I'm at least perhaps naively to some degree, but I think optimistic that as open business models have developed, as sharing itself by entities that seemed opposed to it is being done more and more, that perhaps we could have the same potential down the road with the commons, which leads to that last question that I want to close with before I ask about your next projects, which is what voids are there other than as you point out, analyzing with more detail some of the prime examples of what might be a commons. What else should researchers be focusing on? What would you set as their agenda?
Well, so the specific thing to focus on within a particular commons is what are the rules, right? So commons, back to where we started the conversation this morning, commons are rhetorically thought of sometimes as these open, lawless environments where anything goes once the content gets dumped in. And our research really pushes back very strongly against that assumption. That there are rules. They might be legal rules that are relevant to making the commons go. They might be informal rules or social norms that are important to making the commons go. But understanding what those rules are, where they come from, how they work, how they might be improved to enhance the functioning of the commons, or sometimes to disable the functioning of the commons, because as I said earlier, not all commons are hunky-dory wonderful things. But understanding those rules is really, really a critical thing to think about going forward. You know, there's a lot of obviously legal research on rules in the cultural environment designed to make sure that markets for IP and markets for culture work more effectively. But what we're trying to say is that a lot of study needs to go into how those rules can work to make commons environments work as well.
Mike Madison of Pitt Law. I'm want to ask you as a last question, your next projects, and I know that you are an active blogger, so for those that want to learn more about your work, where can they go?
I do continue to blog at madisonian.net. The Commons Project continues. This first paper that we've been talking about this morning really was very consciously designed as kind of a commons in itself. Brett Frischman, Kathy Strandberg, and I are continuing to collaborate. There are case studies to pursue. There are conferences to organize. There are collaborators worldwide that we would love to have join us in this interest and talk with us about how to extend the work that we've been doing. So I'd say that the top of my agenda is to continue to expand and extend this idea of commons research, both in the larger theoretical sense, but especially in the nitty-gritty case study, how do these actually work sense. Some of that gets reflected on the blog, and some of it will get reflected in additional papers. I should add that the one related thing that I continue to be interested in pursuing is a little bit sort of back to the future thinking and researching in IP. And that is the theme of intellectual property law as a driver of knowledge. In most of what IP arguments today consist of are arguments about creativity and arguments about innovation. And I can't displace those themes, and I don't want to displace those themes. But I do think that an early, very important theme of IP going back centuries was the idea of IP as a driver of human knowledge. And I really am trying very hard in a series of papers to revive that and to tease out its implications, to show how modern copyright and patent law have really lost their way to a certain degree by abandoning the language and concepts surrounding development of knowledge.
And you know, as you know, Mike, I mean, my focus thus far has been on how IP has been used to foreclose the sharing of knowledge through trade secrecy. So perhaps one of those future collaborators might be you and I working together on one of these projects. Mike Madison of Pitt Law, and co-author of the article "Constructing Commons in the Cultural Environment," which I should mention has been published, and the citation for it, and where can people get the article, Mike?
It's in the Cornell Law Review.
Yep, and it's on SSRN as well, correct?
And it's on SSRN, and I should note that I'm going to pull the citation up here for you real fast. The Cornell Law Review published it last year in conjunction, as you mentioned earlier, volume 95 at page 657, in conjunction with reply articles by a series of all-star legal scholars and economists who took some time to very generously engage with our ideas. Eleanor Ostrom was among them. Also, Wendy Gordon, who's a very senior, well-known legal scholar, Rob Merges, Thrane Egertson, who's an economist at NYU, Larry Solom, who is a well-known legal scholar and legal philosopher. We got some wonderful feedback on the article that has really provoked us into thinking even more critically about the project and how we should pursue it going forward.
Mike, thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture. I invite you back as the project continues to discuss this exciting work.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
My pleasure. I'm excited to mention very quickly the guests coming up for the remaining dates that we have this quarter. Jaime Cascio next week will be on discussing his book, Hacking the Earth. Professor Andy Hiley of Elon University School of Law discussing online sales taxation. Professor John Taranian of Chapman University School of Law, author of Infringement Nation. As always, you have a number of ways that you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen live Tuesdays from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time on KZSU FM. You can also get the show by podcast by going to Stanford Center for Internet Society's iTunes page, by getting the show at the website for Stanford CIS at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or by going to hearsayculture.com. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. Thank you much for joining me today on the show. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.